Welcome to our May 2014 RAM session. Thank you for coming. Today our session is going to be on the other compliance. We've talked a lot about all the financial, the administrative compliance. Today we're actually going to be talking about ethical compliance, what it means and how it impacts access to funds and ongoing access to funds. Before I get to our introduce our speakers, what is this? Oh, agenda. Before I get to this, RAN updates, that's what I want to do. For the June session, we are going to be proposing that we do another InfoEd walkthrough. So I know that there's been interest in that from some of you, so that is the plan. I'm seeing yeses, nods. Yes?
I'll just jump in to say I know some people wanted to have it with the computers, so everyone could sit at the computer and kind of follow along. However, unfortunately, I did follow up on that, but the School of Continuing Studies is undergoing a major renovation right now. So as some of you may know, you can't actually access those rooms until at least the fall. So with that in mind, I think this will be the easiest way. And then after that, if we still need to hold a session, we can hold a session in the fall, or I can meet one-on-one with people if they're really having issues. But this will be the easiest way to get that training underway.
Makes perfect sense. So we're going to send out through the RAN a sign-up so that we have an idea of how many people are going to come and all that. Well, actually, no, because we're going to do a general presentation. But we're going to try and tie it to how to use InfoEd for your day-to-day administration, what to look for, the information that's there that can help you manage your funds, help the PIs with questions they may have. There really is a lot of information in InfoEd that can be used, that should be used. So we're really going to try and focus on that during the presentation as well. So if there are people in your areas that you believe would benefit from using InfoEd, please, please, please have them attend the session. If they don't have access to InfoEd, let us know. We will give them access. InfoEd is a tool that we should all be using. So we shouldn't be shying away from using it because we're not comfortable with it. Go in there, play with it. It's not going to crash. You're not going to delete files. It's a tool. Use it. I strongly recommend it. And again, if there's anybody around you who you see is not using it, would benefit from it, let us know. We'll give them access based on their org account and access. So that will be the June session. And then the July and August will be repeats of our bread and butter provincial agencies. So the FRQ is what we're really going to concentrate on. And that will be a repeat June and July. And then September, we're back to the usual monthly sessions. Yes?
Sorry, I have a microphone here. Did you want to mention indirect costs for the FRQ just quickly? Just quickly so people understand what's going on.
Okay. that's a good point. The provincial government has changed the way that they allocate indirects to McGill University or to provincial institutions, where before the provincial government would give an envelope to the universities or academic institution, hospitals, whatever, based on a formula that they did behind the scenes at their end, and then they would just funnel an envelope to the institution. With the government Marois Politique Nationale de Recherche that they issued in the fall of 2013, there was a different way of calculating and distributing the indirect costs on those projects. We didn't know what was going to happen with the change in government, if they were going to continue with the PNRE. And lo and behold, when the notices of awards came in for the new 14-15 awards, there were indirects on those awards directly budgeted per project. So they will be allocating per project based 27% of indirect costs. So the investigators now see the indirects that's being allocated on a per project budget. Those will be assessed like any other grants and contracts that we have. But instead of being 15 or 40 or 30 based on McGill's established rates, it will be sponsor rate at 27%. And those funds will continue to go to an institutional budget provost office for distribution and support of the institution. So if you get questions about those indirects, that is what it is. We are preparing a memo to go out to the community. We still don't know how that will impact interinstitutional transfer of funds. Right now, we are transferring, we're seeing transfers coming in, sub-grants coming in from other Quebec institutions, direct costs only. That's how we're doing it as well. But the discussions will be that eventually the intent will be that you transfer the indirects proportional to the budget that's being allocated to the co-applicants at other institutions. But that we don't know, and we don't know what we're going to do with all of this because it was a surprise to all of us. So more to come. We will, of course, keep you informed of where that all plays out in the near future as we get more information. The other bullet point, RAN update, is I hope that all of you saw the memo that went out last Friday about the new requirements. Again, share as much as you can. If you have investigators or if you have colleagues who might not have seen the memo, we strongly recommend that it be distributed as much as possible. And if you have any questions or if you see that in your area you're not able to comply with the requirements, please talk to your FFOs and ask them questions. Talk to them as to how best you can implement the requirements in the area that you're overseeing. But this is a critical step for us right now. So we really, really need your help in implementing that memo and making sure that the processes and the requirements outlined in there are being met. So if you have any questions, talk to us, talk to your FFOs. Now, going back to the introductions, I will invite Linda McNeil, who is the manager of research ethics, who's responsible for the management of four university research ethics boards. She oversees the ethics review process involving human subjects conducted at all faculties at McGill except medicine and dentistry. Medicine and dentistry are handled by Ildi Lepori. Linda is also a member of the University Advisory Council on Human Research Ethics. She has responsibilities for the development and implementation of policies and procedures related to research ethics, and gives workshops on research ethics to graduate students and faculty. She has a bachelor's in biology here at McGill and is a graduate diploma in administration from Concordia University. So Linda will be talking about the part one, which is research involving human participants, and what it means and how to, just a general overview of what it means to our researchers and to us. Claude Lalande, who's there, will be doing part two, which is understanding the policies and processes governing research involving animals. Claude has been at McGill for a bit. He's a graduate student in biology, so he's been at McGill since 1979. He was on full-time staff since 1982, first as a senior lab technician in biology. He started working in the Stewart Biology building on Dr. Penfield, and as he said, it's been downhill from there. meaning downhill buildings, where he's now located in the James building. And actually, Linda added on top of that that she also started in pathology above Pine, then went down to biology, and then also went down from there. Claude got an MBA from McGill through part-time studies in 1987. He's held various administrative positions, including department assistants, student affairs officers, HR advisor, manager of fellowships and awards, and has become an animal since 2009 in the animal compliance team. So I'm very excited about this presentation. I think we all have a lot to learn, and I'm very grateful that you guys came. Thank you.
Good morning. So here's an overview of the topics I'm going to touch on. I'm really just giving you a big overview of the whole ethics review process and how it works at McGill. I'm going to start by the regulatory framework, why we do what we do and in what context, and what the different rules and regulations are that we have to follow, the organizational structure of the ethics review process at McGill, the scope of review requirements, the ethics review process, and then I have a list of resources. So the regulatory framework, as I'm sure you all know, every institution in Canada that receives funds from any of the three federal funding agencies has to sign a memorandum of understanding, and in that we're bound to uphold the TCPS. The TCPS is the Tri-Council Policy Statement, Ethical Conduct for Research Involving Humans, and that outlines the principles and articles that guide the ethics review process. And besides the TCPS, depending on the type of research that people are doing and where it's located, there's also different relevant federal, provincial, international regulations. For example, we have the Quebec Civil Code that we have to follow, the Quebec Act Respecting Access to Documents Held by Public Bodies, Health Canada for any research involving drugs or devices. There's also the U.S. Code of Federal Regulations, the FDA, depending if the research is being conducted in the state. So there's quite a few rules and regulations that we have to follow. Additionally, there's the McGill Policy on the Ethical Conduct of Research Involving Human Participants, and that articulates the administrative structures, the responsibilities and procedures for the review and conduct of research involving humans that's conducted under the auspices of McGill. And then at another level, we have the different research ethics boards, and each of those have their guidelines, and they're tailored towards the type of research that they review. So the organizational structure, at the highest level, the authority for ethics review, as described in the university policy that I mentioned, is established by the Board of Governors. And then responsibility for oversight of the ethical conduct of research involving humans is entrusted to the Office of the Vice Principal, Research and International Relations. And this ensures that the university's policies and procedures are adhered to and are in compliance with all ethical requirements. We also have an advisory council, the Advisory Council on Human Research Ethics. And this is composed of all of the five Research Ethics Board chairs at McGill. The VP Research also sits on it, or a representative from the VP's office. I'm on it, the senior administration in medicine. We also have a community representative who does not have any ties to McGill who sits on it. And they're responsible for coordinating university-wide understanding and compliance with the different applicable requirements. If you go to the McGill policy, you'll see a list of the responsibilities. I'm not going to go through it all here. And then finally, we have, and most importantly, I think, the Research Ethics Board, which is actually the body established to review the ethical acceptability of the research involving humans. The REBs are accountable at the highest level to the Board of Governors and the Office of the Vice Principal, Research and International Relations, for the integrity of its processes, and has to present an annual report of its activities. But while it's accountable to the Board of Governors for the integrity of its process, the Research Ethics Board is independent in their decision making when it comes to determining the ethical acceptability of the research. The REB membership is dictated by the applicable regulations, primarily by the Tri-Council policy statement. But again, depending who's funding the research and where it's being conducted, there's also regulations from the U.S., from the Department of Health and Human Services, about the composition of an ethics board. Institutional senior administrators are not allowed to be REB members. At a minimum, there has to be five members. It has to consist of someone who's knowledgeable in ethics. There has to be at least one community member who's not from McGill who sits on it. There's also at least two faculty members who are knowledgeable in the area and the methods, the discipline that's being reviewed. And also there's a legal person who has knowledge of the legal issues that might surround the type of research being done. And that's at a minimum that there has to be five. In medicine, for example, there's 16 to 18 people on a committee because you have to have that variety of knowledge around the table for the types of research being reviewed. The other committees, there's approximately an average of 8 or 9 members who sit on it, and they're mostly faculty members from the different departments.
Linda, me. Can we as staff members participate as a member on the Research Ethics Board?
Not normally.
Okay.
Because you have to have someone. You can't be a community member because you're affiliated to McGill. Okay. So the mandate of the REB is to review the ethical acceptability of the research with, of course, the primary objective of protecting the rights and welfare of the participants. The REB can approve, reject, require modifications to, or terminate any proposed or ongoing research involving humans. There are 5 REBs at McGill, and later on I'll go into detail about what they are and what departments serve them. The relevant REB to apply to primarily depends on departmental or faculty affiliation. Researchers located in or who wish to recruit from or conduct research in any of the McGill-affiliated hospitals normally have to apply to the hospital REB and not the McGill campus REBs. Of course, there's some exceptions, and that's why researchers should always call the REB to find out what they have to do. So what is the scope of review requirements? Well, first of all, research requiring ethics review must receive review and approval by a McGill REB or an REB of a McGill-affiliated hospital or an REB recognized by a formal agreement with the university before the research begins. And it has to be before. So even before they start recruiting people, putting up posters, advertising, it all has to get reviewed by the REB first. So the requirement for review applies to all research conducted by or under the supervision of any member of McGill University, whether the research is funded or non-funded, it's not just for funded research, or whether it's conducted at the university or elsewhere, whether in Canada or anywhere in the world. This applies to new faculty who arrive at McGill, even though their current research may have received ethics approval at their previous institution. They can't, once they're a McGill member, they can't conduct that research until they get a McGill approval from a McGill REB. Collaborative research, even if approval has been obtained at another university, so there's cases, we have a lot of collaborative research where the primary investigator may be at another university, so for example, University of Toronto, and our McGill researcher is the co-investigator and the primary person gets their approval at Toronto. The McGill person can't conduct any research or receive any data until they also get approval at McGill. And it can get quite complicated. I just had one where there's 20 researchers across Canada and in Africa, and there's different institutions, and it can get quite complex, but the McGill person always has to have McGill approval in addition to any other approvals from other universities or institutions and follow what their requirements are too. So if someone says, well, no, we already have it. My partner over at Calgary has it. No, they also have to have McGill approval. And they should contact the ethics board to determine the best way of doing that to facilitate the process.
Yeah. Please use the microphone.
Yeah. When there's no need for or there's no human research being done at McGill, do they still need to have on file, or does McGill still need to have on file an ethics certificate from another university? Like maybe the project requires ethics,
right,
but it won't be done at McGill.
It doesn't matter. If the McGill person is involved and in any way in the design of the project, they contribute significantly to the intellectual design, even though they won't conduct the research.
Yeah.
Or if they're getting any data, even if it's been anonymized, they still have to have McGill approval because they're considered, engaged in that research in some capacity. It can get quite complex. There could be some cases where they might not, but they have to contact us. And this is a requirement of the tri-councils, and we really have to have that.
Okay, thank you.
Again, my understanding is, and what I tell PIs is that if we are the lead PI and we are the lead grantee institution, we therefore have oversight responsibility of all conducts, ethical conduct contained in that grant, in that project, and therefore they still need oversight approval and they need to be talking to the ethics offices. Even if the ethical research or the use of animals or humans is being conducted at another site, not at McGill, because we are the lead, we have ownership of that oversight.
But France's question was when we're not the lead, if I'm correct, right? Is that, France, your question was actually when we're not the lead?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes.
So can you clarify the difference that if we're not the lead?
It's both. It's just you always have to have, there's very few exceptions in collaborative research, where you don't need the approval of your own institution. And that would be McGill, Toronto, whoever's involved has to have their own approval. There's different ways of doing it to facilitate. For example, and it depends on the ethics board, it depends on the research being conducted. But for example, if we have someone where the prime is at another university, we'll say, okay, get your approval there. That's where it's being conducted. You're in your overall PI. Get it approved there. Our PI is listed on and what their role is, what they're going to do, and they get their approval. Then they give that to us. They just fill out our McGill cover page, and it gets reviewed by us, but we don't make them fill out a whole other application. But it really depends, and there's different ways of doing it. That's why they should always contact the relevant REB for guidance on that.
Okay, thank you. Yes. Do we need
certificate also when we do not do research, but we would use anonymized data from other university.
Yes, I'll get to that. I'll talk about that. That's secondary data. And again, it depends. Nothing is, well, some things are black and white in ethics, but there's a lot of gray areas. So the requirement for review also applies to student research projects, and that includes research conducted for a thesis or even course requirements. We have a lot of courses, research methods, where the students have to go out, conduct interviews, get people to fill out surveys, very minimal risk research, but it is still research involving humans, and it has to get ethics approval. It includes pilot studies and feasibility studies, and also all research or participant recruitment conducted by organizations or individuals who are not members of McGill University but want to come on campus and recruit our students or use our facilities in some way to conduct the research, excuse me, then they also have to get McGill approval. And also research that involves the use of the university's non-public information, for example, student records. They also have to come and get McGill approval. And there is no retroactive approval. You can't get approval for some research that's already been conducted. Sorry. I'm getting cold now, I think. So what, sorry, I'm getting very choked up. What is research involving humans that needs research ethics review? I really am losing my voice. Oh. Hang on a second. I think I will need more water. Thank you.
Any other questions while we're
sorry.
I can ask a question to, again, give you time to cough. Basically, it really is in terms of what's terminology. Basic question, we hear REB, we hear IRB, we hear certificate, we hear protocol, we hear ethics. So I think for us it would help, and we use it all interchangeably, one to the other. But in terms of either, and maybe Chloe can answer this in Linda's behalf, when you're communicating with PIs, what language do you use? What terminology do you use to communicate with PIs? Do you use ethics? Do you use REB? Do you use IRB? What terminology do you use?
Okay, in the animal world, we actually deal with animal care committees, and that's the terminology we use rather than REBs or IRBs or those various things. And there are different levels of animal care committees. There's the university animal care committee that's in charge of policies. I'll go through that later on. And there's facility animal care committees that actually do review of protocols. We use the term protocol. An animal use protocol is basically the document that is required for approval of a research project involving animals. So I think Linda can now.
I'm partially recovered now. I'll just answer Marlene's question. IRB is Institutional Review Board, and that's an American term.
Okay.
And so that's it's inherited for that because they got established earlier in the U.S. than in Canada. But in Canada, thank you. In Canada, they're called Research Ethics Boards, or REBs.
Okay.
And also the use of the word protocol, like what's your protocol, that's also of a medical nature, because research ethics really started in the medical world, in the biomedical world, and you had a certain protocol that you had to follow when you're doing clinical trials. But we also use the term proposal. It's your proposal, your research proposal. But those terms are all used interchangeably.
Okay, and the word certificate also?
Certificate is the approval.
It's the approval.
It's the approval. Some people call it a letter, some people call it a certificate. But
it's all interchangeable.
It's the approval, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
So what is research involving humans that needs REB review? First of all, it has to meet the TCPS definition of what is a human participant. And the definition is a living human participant whose data or responses to interventions, stimuli, or questions by the researcher are relevant to answering the research question. So that's a pretty broad scope defining what is a human participant. It also applies to human biological materials, as well as human embryos, fetuses, fetal tissue, reproductive materials, and stem cells from living or deceased individuals. So really, the requirement for review and what is research involving humans covers a wide range of research areas across many disciplines, and it can range ranging from clinical drug trials, which everybody associates with human research, to something as simple as an anonymous survey on eating habits. So it's really, it's not just biomedical, it covers a broad range of human research. The requirement for REB review, and this goes back to what Jana was asking before, extends to the secondary use of data, which refers to the use of information originally collected for a purpose other than the newly proposed research project. So if someone, for example, had done some research and collected blood samples and did research on diabetes, and then someone in another lab or a colleague is going to do research on some other disease and said, well, they have all these blood samples collected. Let's just use that. We don't have to go back to people and collect blood again. It could be done, but you have to get ethics review first. You just can't trade off the data. And that goes for non-biological materials, just data, and you have to get REB approval. Again, there are some exceptions that I'm not going to go into here, but normally you do, so you should always check with the REB to find out what review requirements are needed. Researchers are responsible for ensuring their research receives the necessary ethics review and must always consult with the REB to clarify what types of research must be reviewed and what exceptions may exist. If just anyone talks about doing any kind of research and there's a human involved in some capacity, they're talking about focus groups or something, just, you know, be on the alert and say, oh, maybe that needs ethics review, and to tell them to just always call the research ethics office to find out. Yeah.
That's what I was going to ask. If someone is interested, what kind of contact do they, make a phone call? Do they send an email? What's the appropriate way to begin the process?
Just to call it. They can send an email or call, either way. I have the contact information later for each of the ethics boards, and they can contact us. For in my office that has the REB 1, 2, and 3, and also agriculture, we have open drop-in sessions every Wednesday from 2 to 4. Anybody can come in with a draft application or if they're just planning the research and ask any questions. And you can also call the other ethics boards. They're always, that's what they're there for. They're there to help. 2 to 4, my office. So what is the ethics review process? For submission, you start by consulting the website of the relevant REB that has all the forms and the submission requirements. Every REB has their own, you know, particularities, how they like it submitted and what the required documents are. So consult the website. Contact the REB office for guidance. We're there to help. Time-wise, everyone always says, how long does it take? And it's really difficult to predict. But you have to allow a minimum of at least 3 to 4 weeks for review, with further time needed to address any concerns that were identified by the review that the researcher has to get back and address, then send it in and has to get reviewed again before the final approval is given. And the turnaround time depends on many factors, including the complexity of the project and also the completeness of the application. Because we do a pre-review first, and many times things are missing For example, all the recruitment materials have to be in there, ads, posters, any materials that are being used, people don't include them, or they forget to include the consent form, or they don't have a list of the interview questions, or in whatever way it's incomplete. So that also slows things down.
Linda, do we require that the consent forms be both in English as well as translated in French? Is that a requirement that we have here in Quebec or not?
It depends. You'll find out from the ethics, but it really depends what group's being interviewed, like what the interview group is that's being recruited. If you're in hospitals, I mean, I don't work in the hospital, but I know in the hospital they have a requirement when the research is conducted there that it all has to be translated and has to be back translated and certified. So every place has their own requirements.
Okay, but it is something that should be considered and may potentially be requested by the REB to proceed with the full approval.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So once the application is complete, it gets submitted for review, and the REB first determines the type of review that has to be conducted. So there's a full board review, which means that there's a face-to-face convened meeting with quorum of the REB. It's the default, but definitely mandatory for all research that's greater than minimal risk. However, we are allowed to do what we call delegated reviews, where only one or two members of the ethics board has to review it. And that's for minimal risk projects. And minimal risk is research in which the probability and magnitude of possible harms implied by participation in the research is no greater than those encountered by participants in those aspects of their everyday life that relate to the research. And that's the TCPS definition of what minimal risk research is. In the non-medical REBs, the percentage is probably 90% are delegated review and 10% are full board review. And in the medical one, it's reversed. It's about maybe 80% get full board review and 20% are delegated reviews. So an outcome of a review.
Sorry, me again, another question. People, I think, and including me, often assume that surveys, focus groups, questionnaires, will often be, or use of secondary data, will often be coded as minimal risk and go therefore through the delegated review.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct? Or I know again it's gray, you can't say yes or no, but average?
It really depends what the issue is.
So a because survey can be coded as needing full board review.
It could, depending what the population is, because you have to consider the vulnerability. What are the nature of the question? Are you asking them about, drug abuse, if they're criminal if there's criminal activity? It really depends. It could be a wide range of research topics, so that might move it into needing full board review. So an outcome of a review, the application can be approved outright with nothing further needed, no changes. It can be endorsed with conditions that have to be met before final approval is given. It can also be where a decision is deferred. It's not disapproved, but based on the information provided, the decision is deferred pending additional information and major revisions, or it can be outright disapproved that it can't be done.
I have a question on that. How often are things outright disapproved?
It happens more in medicine, but it's still not a huge percentage. You know, it might be, maybe 10 in a year. And in the other boards, 1 year we had 3, another time there's none. So it really, it's very, very rare that something would be disapprove, which just means it could not be done because it's not ethically acceptable. But usually we try and do what's deferred and work with the researcher so that something can be done.
So in those cases, they would have to completely revise and resubmit?
Exactly.
Okay.
So how is the review conducted? The Tri-Council Policy Statement has 3 guiding ethical principles for the conduct of research, regardless of the discipline or the level of risk. It's respect for persons, which translates into the respect for autonomy and the requirement to seek free informed consent, and to protect those with developing impaired or diminished autonomy. The concern for welfare, what is the impact on the physical, mental, emotional, even economic well-being of a participant, and justice, which is the obligation to treat people fairly and to have an equitable distribution of burdens and benefits. So flowing from these principles and the specific requirements dictated by the applicable regulatory framework that the review requires, the REB assesses the ethical acceptability of a project. They consider considering foreseeable risks. What are the risks involved? Can they be mitigated? Are there any risks? What are the potential benefits? So there's a risk-benefit ratio. And they also consider issues such as recruitment methods. Like I said before, we need to see everything that's going to be used for recruitment and what are the emails being sent out. How are you contacting people? Because there's issues of privacy to consider. What is the proposed methodology? Is it focus groups, interviews? Is it a clinical trial? Is it a behavioral intervention? Is counseling involved? Is there videotaping? Is there tape recording? All these issues are considered. And we also consider compensation, what kind of compensation is being offered, what is the vulnerability of the participants, the informed consent process is reviewed, issues of privacy and confidentiality. We are also concerned with security of data. How is it being maintained throughout the life of the project, not only at the collection, but also during during the research, and then after the research is concluded, how is the data, the identifiable data, being kept secure, and who's going to have access to it? And also issues of conflict of interest. So all these things are looked at, and it, the weight given to each really depends on the type of research that's being done. Once someone gets approval, the approvals are only valid for a maximum of 1 year, and if the project is ongoing, they have to get a continuing review. And the approval, it's for 1 year, and no research may be conducted without a current ethics approval, and project funding will be frozen if an ethics approval lapses and the research is still ongoing and it's linked to funding. But I think maybe Marlene will talk about that a little bit later. Modifications to the project, such as changes in the research design, the informed consent process, recruitment, or any changes that may increase the risk level, have to be approved by the REB before they can be initiated, except in cases where it's necessary to reduce harm to a participant. Any unanticipated issues that increase the level of risk or have any other ethical implications that may affect the participant's welfare have to report it in a timely manner to the ethics board. And then they reevaluate the project and see if any changes need to be made. And again, I emphasize this, there's no retroactive approval. Noncompliance can have serious consequences, such as inability to use the data collected, non-acceptance of a thesis, loss of funding, or suspension of research. I also have a note here, I didn't know where else to fit it in the presentation, that claims for reimbursement of participant payments, participants get compensated often for their participation, have to respect the confidentiality promised to the participants. So that means that the person's name can't be on the request. These requests should be submitted with a disclaimer stipulating that the research is confidential and no names will be provided. And that would even mean that unless you or anyone else who's making these claims was listed in the consent form as having access to their identity, should not be having access to that. Because typically a consent form will say something like only myself and my supervisor, or if it says the research team, then maybe it's okay, we'll have access to any identifiable information. this applies to expense reports and payment requests and was confirmed by Julie Gayette, Associate Director. Process Improvement and Finance Infrastructure, we got that clarification a couple of years ago.
I guess that basically means that you're not going to put in an expense report for somebody who may need to be reimbursed because of their name if they've signed a confidentiality clause. Is that what that means? It means that the expense has to go through somebody else?
No, no, it means when you make the make the claim, if a researcher pays out, compensates a participant, mm-hmm. and then they make the claim, mm-hmm. they can't, I haven't seen how it's done, but they can't put that participant's name saying, I paid Joe Smith $50, compensated them $50 for their participation. Mm-hmm. They just say, participant X. Okay. And you can keep the record of who XYZ is, but when you submit it to finance, you can't have that participant's name on it.
Thank you.
What if it's the parents, like, what if the subject is a child and it's the parent's name on the receipt? Is that allowed?
They're still confidential. It should be blocked out, or X, or however it's done, but they're also promised confidentiality.
In regards to the what you just discussed about no retroactive approval given, mm-hmm. and that it could impact potential, inability to publish your thesis and all that, is it correct in my understanding that a lot of journals now also require that the PIs document the REB approval that was obtained prior to them accepting the manuscript? Can you, that is my understanding, but it's not clear.
No, it is. That's what I've been told too, that most journals will ask for the ethics approval when they're submitting for publication. So I have here a list of, I'm getting better now at the end of the talks. McGill-approved research ethics boards. So we have the actual McGill campus research ethics boards. Like I said before, we have 5 research ethics boards, and a researcher's designated REB is usually determined according to the unit of the researcher's primary academic appointment, although in consultation among the chairs, if it's determined that another board has better knowledge of the type of research being done, it can be reviewed by another board at McGill. So we have one out at McDonald campus, one for the Faculty of Agriculture and Environmental Sciences. Faculty of Medicine has an ethics board, and they also have an ethics office for all members in the Faculty of Medicine and Dentistry. Then we have University Ethics Board 1, 2, and 3. We were very original in our naming of the boards. And I won't read out all the departments that fall under it, but you'll see there's University Ethics Board 1, which is mainly law and arts. And then we have Research Ethics Board 2, which is mostly psychology and faculty of education. And I'll point out that this all, for these boards, it's all research involving competent adults, because then we have REB 3, which is for members in all those units except medicine and dentistry for research that involves minors or adults not competent to consent. So we have a board that specializes, that does that kind of review for that research involving minors. And then another McGill-approved boards are the Affiliated Hospital Research Ethics Boards. The university recognizes the research ethics boards of the affiliated hospitals as acting on behalf of the university for ethics review for McGill members who are located in or conducting research in the following affiliated hospitals: the MUHC, the Douglas, Jewish General, and St. Mary's. We also have 2 other boards, or one is a board, the CREER, for any member conducting research within one of the establishments of CREERs. They have several rehab facilities. And then a new addition is the entente that we have with other Quebec universities for minimal risk research. If it's collaborative research, so this is one of the exceptions that I talked about, when you need to get approval from every institution for every collaborator or co-investigator involved. If it's with another Quebec university, not hospitals, just universities, and it's minimal risk research, you only need to get approval from the REB of the prime PI. You still have to be listed. If you're the co-investigator, you have to be listed and your role clearly identified, but only one REB review. That review has to be sent to us, for example, if we're not the prime, just so we can see it and say, yes, we accept it. It doesn't go for review to an REB member. It's just to determine that it is minimal risk research and that we accept it. So there's a procedure we have to follow, but it's been figured out amongst all the universities. So if it does involve collaborative research among Quebec universities, you should really contact your REB to find out what the procedure is so that you don't get more reviews than you have to. The REBs, my office and medicine, offers education sessions to anyone who's interested, to departments, groups, instructors upon request, so anybody wants that. I give 10 or 12 a year. I get calls from courses or departments, and in medicine gives some to, and it can be focused on a particular issue, whether it's minors, informed consent, or just a general overview of what the main issues are. I go into a lot more detail about the consent issue, recruitment, privacy issues, go into more specific details on that. I mentioned we have drop-in consultations in our office for applications that would go to REB 1, 2, or 3, or agriculture. I have the links to all the McGill Research Ethics Board on our webpage. It has the general information, guidance documents, and where you go depending on what department that you're in. There's a link to the McGill policy on the ethical conduct of research, and all researchers who are going to conduct research with humans should really be familiar with that. Links to the Tri-Council policy statement, which goes into detail. I mean, it's a printed document, comes out that thick, but it's a good idea for someone to at least be familiar with, might not know it in detail, but be familiar with it if they're going to conduct research involving humans. And also, just a note, we have a lot of researchers too who do research in Nunavut, Yukon, or the Northwest Territories, and all these areas require research licenses in addition to Research Ethics Board, and they need the license even if it's not human participant research. Just if they're going to conduct any research in those areas, they need to get research licenses, and I've heard sometimes it can take a while, so people should be aware of that. And that's it. That's my part. Yes?
Okay, I have a question about what happens when, internally, when a grant is awarded, what happens between OSR and your office? Because if I recall correctly, automatically the PI is informed that they need ethics approval. Is that right?
Yes, I'll go over, I'll wait for Claude's presentation because it's very much tied, and I'll, at the end, I'll come back and explain how compliance requirements works with OSR and how we come into the picture.
Okay.
But I'm going to do it at the tail end of the presentation.
Okay, thank you.
But whether they're getting funding or not, the researcher should know when they need, that they need to get ethics approval, because sometimes people are going to do the research anyway, whether they get the funding or not. Then they should start the process so that it's ready when you do get funding, because you will need it. Like Marlene will explain that in more detail later.
Yeah, just to
however, I just wanted to say, in medicine, they have a little different system. If because we ask when people are making the application if there's funding, and they indicate if it's pending. And in medicine, if you're not going to conduct the research if you don't get the funding, there's no ethics review until the funding's awarded, because then, you know, it's a waste of time to do an extensive review when you're not even going to take part in the research if you don't get the funding. Someone in the back have a question?
Yeah, I've been reading that the university is going to be reviewing the ethics, something about ethics. I'm wondering how it relates to this.
They're talking about the what do they call it? The regulation on the responsible conduct of research. So it's not human research ethics, it's just research ethics in the broader sense.
Your slides for scope of review requirements, it's mentioned an REB recognized by a formal agreement.
Yeah, that would be an example like the Entente.
The Entente, okay.
Yeah. Because before we had the Entente, that formal agreement, if you were, you know, collaborators in three Quebec universities, you had to go to the REBs and get three separate REB reviews, and now you
that
only need to get one.
An example.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
On the note of the entente, I know that other provinces have kind of done certain things where some universities will accept other universities. You know, so they don't necessarily require reviews every time, but it seems to be very provincially based. There's never going to be a Canada-wide kind of agreement, is there? We can always assume if there's different provinces, you'll at least need two different protocols, or two different submissions, right? Is that generally how it's going to go?
Yeah. Yes?
The submission of the initial application is not done online, isn't it, like for the human, the animal?
No, we'd like to have it.
Okay.
But no, we don't have that.
Okay, and for the renewal, what's the timeline we're talking about?
You said the renewal is very quick. It is normally very quick. It's a one-page form.
Okay.
And
you
submit
get a
that.
Prompt when it's due and...
Normally
we do, okay.
But if you don't get one, it's still the responsibility of the PI to make sure that they get it renewed on time.
Okay.
But we do our best to send out several reminders. But, yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions?
We can take more questions at the end. Like after, if people still have questions after... second presentation, we can come back and we'll have more questions, but I think we'll turn it over to Claude.
Okay. Hello, everyone, and Marlene insisted that the little penguin be there. He's my logo on the link system for instant messaging at McGill. I would just like to ask, are there any people here from the affiliated hospital institutes? Okay, because it's a little bit different from human ethics, so I'd like to address a few of the issues regarding the affiliated institutes. So basically at McGill, we have a board of governors approve policy on animal care. And I've taken two quotes from the policy on the study and care of animals that pretty much explains our core mission. And the first little bullet is we are committed to the well-being of animal subjects. That's really our core mission. The well-being of animal subjects is important for many reasons. First of all, because there's public awareness of animal welfare, and some people do not agree with the use of animals in research because they don't consent. And the second reason is really that in order to get meaningful research and good research, we need to have animals that are well treated, because we don't want to introduce all kinds of artifacts in the research that come from diseases and bizarre treatment, or animals that don't behave normally because they're not in their natural environment. So that is really, really the core mission in our program. And one of the other aspects in the core mission in the first paragraph is that we have to ensure that the research involving animal subjects has undergone peer review for scientific merit. Okay, that's not just McGill's policy, it's also a CCAC policy, and I'll get into who the CCAC is. So, peer review for scientific merit and review of the animal care and animal procedures and all the conditions in which the animals are treated by an animal care committee. So that's part of the core mission. Okay. And it carries significant responsibility to do animal research, not only, I already said, not only in the public eye, but also in terms of the quality of research that's done. So we continually update our policies and standard operating procedures and put every condition in place as much as possible to maintain and develop the best possible animal care. And we're governed by the Canadian Council on Animal Care. Why should we really bother? And why should we really be bothered about animal care when the animals used in research represent in Canada that little tiny slice of the animals used in Canada? Because the most important part are the chickens you eat on a daily basis or a weekly basis, unless you're vegan or vegetarians. So why should we really care, especially when the majority of animals are, that are used in research are mice and rats? Okay. People don't tend to care a lot about mice and rats. They even don't like them in their houses, but we care. Okay. Just to give you an idea, people have perceptions sometimes in the general public about the various species we use, and you see videos from PETA about treatment of primates and dogs and cats and pets. They represent a very, very small proportion of the animals that are used in research. So still, why do we care? Okay. It's because the public in survey after survey tends to support the use of animals in research, especially biomedical research, because it does provide benefits. But they do also express concerns about the treatment of animals. So we have to be absolutely above board in terms of how we treat our fellow animals. And we are animals too. Okay, and we want assurances that they're treated humanely, they don't suffer, and they're kept under conditions that allow them to be as healthy and comfortable as possible. Okay. So there are five freedoms in terms of our treatment of animals. Freedom from hunger and thirst, freedom from discomfort, from pain, injury, and disease, freedom to express normal behavior, and freedom from fear and distress. And these are addressed by a principle that's applied across the board in animal research, the three R's, which is replace, and I haven't made a slide on this, replace, so we replace animal models whenever possible with in vitro models. Okay, reduce, we try to have models that will reduce the number of animals we have to use in research. And refine, and the refinement will often address a lot of these concerns. Freedom from pain, injury, and disease, for instance, the refinements. Here at McGill, we do not allow pain that is not alleviated by anesthetics or analgesics in the conduct of research, or pain where they can, the animal can withdraw or be withdrawn from a dangerous situation. Those are considered. There are five levels of invasiveness in research with animals, A to E. E is really unalleviated pain, and we do not conduct any of that at McGill. Okay, so that will come in play when I address some interinstitutional projects at some point, because some institutions do allow it. Okay, A-level research, which is basically observation only, do not require a protocol, but from B to D, they will require a protocol. So I'll address first the regulatory environment. At some point in the past, I think it's 1968, but I'm terrible with dates, NSERC and CIHR have created an independent organization called the Canadian Council on Animal Care, or CCAC. They've added the in science to their title. The reason for that is because their mandate was sometimes not clear with the general population. They thought, a lot of people thought that the CCAC oversaw legislations about animal abuse, etc., in the world, and puppy mills and stuff like that. They don't. Their mandate is clearly to deal with animals used in science. And the CCAC provides standards and guidance, assessment and certification, and education and training. And they delegate some of that to the institutions, of course. So the Tri-Council Agreement on the Administration of Agency Grants and Awards by Research Institutions that replaced the Memorandum of Understanding requires that any institution administering Tri-Council funding and conducting research with animals be accredited by the CCAC. So it means that any organization must be accredited, and our industrial partners that get involved in industrial grants, for instance, from CIHR and CERC, the Fonds Québécois, they have to be accredited by CCAC. Otherwise, it's not mandatory if they're fully privately funded. Okay. Other funding agencies in Canada and internationally, they recognize the CCAC certification for research conducted here. And for U.S. grants and agreements, in addition, we have to apply and obtain an animal welfare assurance from NIH, and we have an assurance number. So for grant applications for U.S. agencies, there is a McGill NIH Animal Welfare Assurance Number, and we provide that to people when they apply. Okay, so the big difference in terms of the human and animal side is that McGill and its affiliated hospital institutes actually are jointly certified and have an integrated program across the board for all the institutions. Okay, and we hold the joint valid NIH assurance. Okay. The main requirements for CCAC certification: institutional compliance with the CCAC policy statements, and there are several of them. We have to have an animal care committee, and I'll show you the structure of our committees in an upcoming slide. The animal care committee is responsible for the policies and the approval of research, teaching, and testing protocols. Okay, and they have terms of reference for animal care committees. So, for instance, there is a quorum that has to be met. Committee has to include researchers, has to include vets, has to include a community representative at minimum. And in addition, there can be other members. So the other members that we have are staff members from the animal facilities, both in terms of the animal facility management, just to look at, is this something we can do in our facilities? When they approve a protocol, animal health care technicians are on our committees. Jennifer Henry, who is in the audience here, is our training administrator, is an electronic member of all our animal care committees. And for the reason that everyone has to have valid training certification to be on an animal protocol and to actually use animals or to be a PI. Jennifer actually would review electronically all the protocols and amendments that deal with adding personnel or adding procedures for personnel to ensure that that personnel has the required training. And electronic approval in the case of Jennifer is very appropriate because she's a very high voltage person. So it really fits her level of energy. Okay. And the CCAC actually certifies every 3 years through an assessment visit, and they're changing a little bit the format right now of these assessment visits, but we get certification either satisfactory, we could be probationary, but we're not, or denied certification after an assessment visit. Okay, so just to tell you, McGill and affiliated research institutes hold a valid CCAC certification. It's evidenced by valid certificates of good animal practice. And we are listed on the CCAC website. So if ever an outside collaborator wants to see, is McGill covered by CCAC, there is a list of certified institutions on the CCAC website. Our structure, basically, as I said earlier, we have a Board of Governors approved policy, and that puts in place a structure. We have a very big program across McGill and affiliated institutions, so the head of the program is the Vice Principal of Research and International Relations. Reporting to the vice principal, there is a reporting committee that is more or less informal, but after every policy change or major decisions that are made by our policy governing body, the University Animal Care Committee, we report formally back to the VP. We have several subcommittees, and they all actually have a very important mission in terms of aspects of the program. So the ethics subcommittee is mandated to look at specific ethical considerations when there's new and exciting lines of research that we've never done before, or particularly invasive programs, research involving primates. We don't have too many, but we do have some. The ethics subcommittee looks at the ethical issues linked to that. Training and qualification subcommittees ensures that our training program is up to snuff and constantly improved. Vet care subcommittee, they address, of course, healthcare issues. Community and communications, it's important that we communicate with the the community quite well. The Animal Use Protocol Application Review Subcommittee, we'll get into that a little bit later, but basically a big difference with the human ethics is we have one integrated system with one uniform form across McGill and the affiliated hospitals. So it makes things a little bit simpler, and we actually take input from the various constituents of our program, and the application subcommittee actually looks at improving our application. Occupational health and safety. Of course, you deal with animals, you deal with possibly toxic materials, chemicals, etc. So we have an occupational health and safety subcommittee that deals with that. And the quality assistance, because we're actually responsible to maintain a post-approval monitoring program. So we actually go and visit facilities and researchers, look at their procedures, etc. We have decided as an institution to not to call it post-approval monitoring, because that sounds like the police. And we're not the police. We're really there to assist the researchers in doing high-quality research and improve the techniques, etc., to get there. Okay. There are 10 facility animal care committees, and that is because we have 10 sites. Three at McGill, three at the MUHC, and one MNI, Jewish General, LDI, Douglas and Shriners. So each of them is actually responsible for the approval of the research protocols. Okay, and we have 24 animal facilities. Of course, in terms of the committees and the facilities, we're going to be facing, and we've started working with our colleagues at the MUHC right now, because of the new Glen site, there will be a change in the animal facilities as a result of that. So we've already started working on that. The Animal Compliance Office, we have a role, but we have no authority. It's the committees that have the authority. Okay, so we oversee the regulatory and compliance in research and teaching, and we ensure that we provide the expertise to the committee heads, to the VP research, to the researchers and the research teams in terms of what the regulations are, and help them overcome problems they may have with compliance. Okay, and one of the things we do as well in terms of the financial involvement is the last bullet here, is that at the time of tri-council audits, we're heavily involved in there because the auditors from CIHR and NSERC are really interested in ensuring that grants that involve animal research are covered by valid animal protocols for the duration of the animal work, at least. And we provide documentation for them. And we meet with the auditors to discuss processes at each of the audits. So we're active in that front. Okay. Are there questions in terms of mandates and policies and all of this at this point? No. Okay. So as I said earlier, we have an integrated program, one set of forms only, and we've gone electronic. We're really happy with that. We're the first McGill and affiliated institutions joint system that has been implemented across McGill and the affiliated institutions. We're really pleased with that. So that integrated software platform allows for the completion and submission of animal use protocols, renewals, and amendments. The evaluation and approval is done partly electronically, partly in person. Animal facility administrative functions, and those who are involved in financial management will be interested that we submit, or the PIs submit their animal orders via Darwin, which allows for the validation that they are authorized to order these animals. So it's validated, and that was a requirement of the Tri-Council auditors and of CCAC. Automatic housing charges of active animal cages, the per diems, if you've used that vocabulary. Service charges for supplies and vet care can be also applied through the Darwin system, but Darwin is not a financial system. It calculates charges on approved protocols, and these are entered or fed. We have sites that actually have automatic feeds, some sites don't, in the financial system of the various institutions, either McGill or the affiliated hospitals. Okay. The requirements for animal use in science. So a principal investigator must hold the valid animal use protocol approved by an FACC for all research involving live animals, including vertebrates and some invertebrates that have higher brain functions like octopus and squid. There are some exceptions, as I mentioned earlier. The A levels, when there's observation only without disturbing the animals, etc. But if you advise your researchers, we advise that you do not improvise and refer the PIs consult with the animal compliance office, because there can be confusion. You know, research on an egg, if it's still an embryo in the egg, it doesn't need an animal use protocol, but if it has just hatched, it requires an animal use protocol. So there are little nuances where we have to be a little bit careful with that. Okay, and we have a generic email address so that we don't depend on one particular person. I'll give contact information at the end. The principal investigator's research must have been peer-reviewed for scientific merit. And that's one aspect where we sometimes get into a little bit of delay, because it's clear that a grant that's awarded that covers this animal research is peer-reviewed when it's from a peer-reviewed organizations, and a funding agency, government foundation, private companies running a competitive peer-reviewed award program. Okay, a valid peer review is also evidenced by grants that were recommended for funding, but not funded because of lack of funds. So we have people who do not realize that as long as they had a pass note on their scientific evaluation for the grant, if they didn't get funded, that is evidence of peer review, even though they can use their startup funds or other funds that they've been awarded, that is not peer reviewed. Okay, for non-peer-reviewed sources, other internal funds, company contracts. The peer review can be obtained from the Office of the Associate Dean Research of the faculty or the director of the affiliated institute. Okay. So that sometimes the researcher doesn't realize that the peer review has to be obtained for those sources of funds, and that can create a delay in approval. Okay. So those are the fishy situations. Who can be a principal investigator on a protocol? I used the slide from the last RAND presentation for those who were there. I cheated a bit. So anyone who holds a faculty-level position with a main appointment at McGill can be a PI on a protocol. Adjunct professors, which are typically professors from another institution, research associates, postdoc students, cannot be a PI in their own on their own. They have to be on a protocol held by a faculty level professor. I have a little scenario later on for people who are doing collaborative research. So normally the PI submits an animal use protocol to his home facility animal care committee, because that's where there is control over that person. So in terms of if ever there were a case, and it doesn't happen often, I've known of one or two cases in the last decade, even in the BC era before Claude, that's where the disciplinary authority over the researcher is held. So it has to be at their home committee. One notable exception, because for wildlife research and field work, they have to actually have the proper expertise on the committee. So we've gathered that expertise at the McDonald campus, FACC. Okay. The PI on a grant can be different from the PI on an animal use protocol, and that's important. And the protocol will be submitted to the committee of the PI that will do the animal work on the protocol. Okay. Sometimes one wonders why there is a time involvement in the approval of especially new protocols. Is that there are other approvals required. For instance, permits for hazardous agents. You may have a biohazard certificate for the PI's lab issued from the Environmental Safety Office. But sometimes that's for the biohazard product itself. But once it's gone through an animal and it comes out at the other end of the animal, sometimes these metabolites, the Environmental Safety Office doesn't really know what comes out. So there's literature. So there is, as part of our protocol evaluation, we do an assessment of the biohazards in the context of the animals. So biohazards, radiation, determine proper level of containment, and cells tested for pathogens is another one, because we don't want to introduce diseases in animal facilities. Okay, so training certification, as I mentioned, it's a CCAC requirement that everyone on the protocol must take a course on theory, ethics, and animal care concepts that is relevant to their actual involvement on the protocol. OSC certification as well. So any protocol that involves addition of personnel, there is a step for the training, certification assessment, and requesting additional training if appropriate. There's the occupational health program that's mandatory to work with certain species. If the there is specialized equipment in a researcher's lab, before live animals are used in the lab, initial visit by the FACC is required. After the protocol is approved, and that doesn't involve delays, but there's an annual inspection that's mandatory of every facility and lab where animals are, and post-approval monitoring, as I mentioned. Quality assistance happens. Okay. Back on the Darwin system, I think two of my slides got in the wrong order, but that's my fault. Yeah. So 8 years ago, the CCAC absolutely insisted in their assessment recommendations that we either centralize animal purchasing across McGill and affiliated institutions, so that can't happen because we're separate business entities, or have an integrated system. So we went the road of an integrated system, and that's where Darwin came in since 2011. Okay, so every user of the Darwin system logs in with their McGill credentials. And the PI's homepage, you can't see details on here, but they get alerts for pending action on their side. And as I said, there's actual an actual section for the protocol management, submitting protocols, amendments, animal orders. Their online invoices for their per diem charges and other service charges that are there. And the animal husbandry census, so they can look at where their animals are at any time. Yes?
Can they delegate anybody in the Darwin system? How does that work?
They can delegate for animal ordering. They can delegate for looking at their invoices and reports. They can delegate the preparation of animal protocols, but the PI has to is the only person in the group that can submit a protocol or an amendment. So,
do the people they delegate to, do they have to be trained? Like, can a PI delegate to me as an administrator to go and view the invoices and do that stuff, even if I'm not CC, even if I don't have the certification, the training?
Yes.
Does it have to be somebody who has the training to whom they can delegate to?
No. So there are labs, for instance, big labs, where there's a lab manager who never handles animals. So they are not on the animal protocol, but they have Darwin permission. So those are two different avenues. So yes, if all PIs in the university delegate you, Jennifer will create a profile as a PI group member for 2 million Gute on all protocols across McGill and affiliated the hospitals if they want that. Why not? Okay. Protocol approval process, I'll go through it very quickly. The PI has an active account on the Darwin system, of course. PI or delegate completes a protocol. They submit the protocol electronically to the FACC on Darwin. There's an FACC administrator for each FACC. They submit protocols to the reviewers electronically. The reviewers can enter their comments online, and they're encouraged to do it online. For for the evaluation, for full protocols and some amendments that are very involved, they're practically like a new protocol, it has to be seen by a full committee, but only full protocols, as a rule, have to be seen by the full committee in a meeting. Annual review, which is a very short renewal form, basically a progress report and requesting animals for the following year. They are done entirely electronically, and most amendments are done entirely electronically. So if there are revisions, the PI revises the protocol and submits back to the FACC. The chair grants approval electronically. We are demigods in the ACO and are the only ones who know the secret code to actually process final approval once we realize that all the dots are, the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed. And for OSR administered funds, we link the protocol to funds on InfoEd and we send a nice little email to the OSR awards teams when it's a new grant or a new protocol saying, voila, you may release funds if everything else is okay with the grant. Okay. The timelines for approvals, if you advise people, a new protocol absolutely requires a committee meeting. Typically, 2 or 3 months should be devoted to that, especially if it's a new PI. I've seen new protocols being approved within a month. That happens. But you have to have the stars perfectly aligned because those have to be seen by a meeting, and most FACCs have a meeting every month. They skip months sometimes, so there can be interim approval if it's time sensitive, but that one requires particular attention and early start. Full renewal every 3 years. It requires a committee meeting, typically 1 to 2 months, again because it has to be seen, okay, by a committee. The annual review is normally electronic approval only if the committee members say this has to be seen by full committee. Typically it's 2 weeks to a month, but 2 weeks normally. Amendments, normally electronic approval only. Chair or a subcommittee, it can be referred to a full committee, and typically 2 days to 3 weeks. I've had an amendment approved electronically because the stars were aligned within 2 hours at one point, but it's not typical. And it was an amendment for funding only, and only the chair and myself had to be involved. Okay, so now scenarios. I'll get into the first scenario is for collaborative research, internal and animal work for part of the duration of a grant. Okay, so the scenario I've put there is a computer engineering PI holds a 5-year grant for development of a new brain imaging analysis system. Okay, and collaborates with a PI in neurology and neurosurgery who will test the imaging system in years 3 to 5 of the grant. Okay, so funding agencies require evidence of a valid animal use protocol when animals are used. Okay, so for the first 2 years of the grant, OSR at McGill or Institute grant offices will issue a release of funds authorization, okay, for 1 year renewable. While animals are not used, I'll get into details of that. Before the animal work starts, the PI performing the animal work will submit an animal use protocol. Protocol is approved, we assume. So that protocol will be linked to the grant on InfoEd. So it'll be doctor neurosurgeon protocol number 2345 will be linked to Professor Electrical Engineer's grant on InfoEd. Okay? Let's say the animal work gets completed before the end of the 5 years. The PI retires the protocol, and the OSR may have to release, and I don't know what your processes are. You may want to address that. But we put, we put a comment that an animal certificate is no longer required on InfoEd, and you're covered, but we will talk. I put that in. I wasn't sure, and it was a little bit late. Okay, so the three questions that OSR will ask for release of funds before a protocol is submitted: why is it necessary to access it? They'll approve the prorated amount needed to conduct the research activities. It could be 100% if in the budget it was clear that animal work only starts in the third year, and indicate the actual or anticipated date of AUP submission. Okay. That can happen also for short term. Let's say they get a grant now, they have to do some preliminary work, and it'll take a couple months to get their protocol submitted. They can get a release of funds as well. Okay. For collaborative research external, so I have a scenario that Université de Montréal PI needs to perform animal work at McGill because they don't have the facility for that particular animal model at U of M. The CCAC has a policy on collaborative research between institutions. So an institutional, that's the actual copy and paste of the policy statement. And basically the PI has to submit a protocol to the home institution. So the PI in this scenario will submit to Université de Montréal, but the Université de Montréal committee is required to consult with the host institutions, McGill, Animal Care Committee, and McGill's committee can make recommendations, and they have to agree for this to happen, but it doesn't duplicate the work in terms of protocol being created. Okay. So it's important that the committees communicate then. Okay, so PI submits protocol for review at home. So the home ACC has authority over the PI, disciplinary, responsible conduct of research, etc. The home ACC reviews the protocol and submits to the host. So this, just for those who want to read it later, summarizes what I just said. The approval is granted. The animal work is conducted at the host site. Post-approval monitoring, vet care, etc., is assured by the host site, and that's why we have to approve this. And the host site typically invoices the home institution for housing and services, especially if that grant is held at Université de Montréal. I know there are cases where there are sub-grants, but that's also possible. So there's an invoicing mechanism where the grant is actually charged. So in conclusion, there are several partners in the animal care, and it works best if we're working together, like these frogs. Our contact information, we're one click away. It's easier to handle contact electronically because we have a backup system. So if I'm away in La La Land somewhere, if you write me an email. It's not as easy. So we have all our policies, links to our resources, etc., on our website. Animalcare@mcgill.ca is the first line of contact for general questions. For Darwin system support, darwin@mcgill.ca. And I guess we can, Marlene wanted to talk about coordination with grants. Yes.
Okay. One point, I want to make sure I understood it properly. You said the PI can be different on the protocol than the main PI holding the grant, right?
That's right.
But in this case, it would have to be a co-applicant, right, on the project?
The PI on the grant, if they don't do any animal work, they would be listed as a collaborator, but they wouldn't be in the personnel section on the protocol, so they wouldn't have to have been trained for animal use.
Okay, I understand.
But they're listed in a section called the internal collaborators.
But the person that the protocol will be issued to, he would have to be a co-applicant on the research project?
Not necessarily. It can be a collaborator because in cases where it's a research team that doesn't have expertise in animal care, they may bring someone into the project as an advisor because they have access to the animals that they need, but they don't have the expertise on the actual project. So the co-applicants and the PI may be completely separated from the animal care, and they're leaving it to an advisor or consultant to do that work and report back to them.
Okay, so it could be an outsider,
yeah,
but would require a McGill animal certificate.
If the animal work is done at McGill under the oversight of a McGill researcher, it's a McGill certificate.
Okay.
Yes.
I didn't realize outsiders could come in.
Yeah, they don't have to have a co-applicant
status
the grant application.
Okay.
Co-applicant implies that they are a co-investigator and they have some intellectual participation in the conduct of the project and
exactly.
The analysis and the publications and all that.
Right.
But it doesn't mean that the person who's actually doing the animal work, they may have a model that they just, you know, run the mice or run the rats through their standardized models, and the PI of the grant is going to say, I just need you to take your rats and run them through this. And the PI, the person who has the animal capacity will do that, but they're not co-applicants. After
okay.
that, once
I,
they run
I've never
them,
encountered it yet.
So yeah, so it doesn't matter whether they're co-applicants or collaborators is somewhat irrelevant for us.
Okay, so but you say this is rare because I've never encountered
this is actually the majority of cases, actually the PI on the protocol is a co-applicant,
yeah.
But I've seen it happen.
It happens sometimes with NSERCs. We see it more with NSERCs than we do with biomedical because with NSERC researchers, they tend not to have animal expertise. So they're bringing in someone who does.
Okay, thank you. I really need a clarification.
Yeah.
There's
another question?
Yes, I was just wondering if one animal protocol, if the techniques and use of the animals and numbers is identical, can it be linked to two different funding sources?
That's a very good question.
Yes, actually there's no one-to-one relationship, and there's no rule on that, but it can be a matter of practicality. So there could be one grant that's very broad in spectrum, but there are different, very defined animal work parts, and they can have a couple of different protocols. And we have a case, actually, if I can give an example generically, of a researcher who does lab work and has created a protocol for the lab work, and they have field work. And they have created a protocol for their field work component. And they were actually evaluated by two different committees.
And I would say that also applies to human subjects as well,
yeah.
Where you can have one approved REB or animal protocol, but have it linked to multiple grants.
Yes.
That was one of my comments that I was going to make, because one of the issues that we have a lot in OSR is that the PIs get a new grant, and then they say, oh, I have an existing approval, here you go. And they just think that they can piggyback on those existing animal or ethics approval, and that's problematic. They may be able to do that, but they still need to contact the compliance offices and either amend their protocols accordingly to reflect that there is a new funding source that's going to support this protocol. But that, I have to say, is one of our biggest struggles, is that the PIs often will say, you know, we get a brand new CIHR grant, and they already have an existing protocol. You're like, okay, yes, that's all fine and dandy. You may have an existing protocol, but please, you still probably need to do an amendment to acknowledge that there's a new source of funding. So any new grants will require, we will send back the PIs to the compliance offices. They can't use just their existing approvals.
But it doesn't necessarily need to go through the full committee. It can be done as an amendment.
Yeah. Correct. Or depending on the project, right?
Yeah. If it's only adding a new source of funding for the exact same project,
exactly,
they happen to have have a new source and it's the same protocol, the chair and myself typically will be the only ones involved in the approval process, and that was a case where we had a two-hour turnaround, and in one case the stars were aligned.
But I think the PIs definitely need to, that's a message I think that we really need to take home more and more to them, is to say, you still need to do an amendment at a minimum. If the specific aims in the new grant require something, a change to the existing protocol, or they're going to be doing something more, they're going to be doing a new survey or a new focus group, or they're going to be getting more data, they may need to get a new protocol, or they may need to create a bigger amendment than just acknowledging a new source of funding. So it really depends on what the new grant is for. But that is one of the big take-home messages that we're asking for your help, is that getting the word out there that a new source of funding, we will be looking for an amendment. At a minimum, we'll be looking for an amendment. And as Claude mentioned, we work very closely both with Linda and Ildi, and of course the animal compliance with them a lot when we get new funds. We are required by Tri-Agency and many of our granting agencies to track approvals before we authorize release of funds. We also have to do continuous monitoring, so we're constantly having to, every month, generate reports. We're in the process of setting up a process for that. It is one of our tri-agency findings that we have to implement a new a process where every month we are tracking lapsed protocols. So is there a grant that had an approval and that approval lapsed? We don't have an updated REB approval. We don't have an updated animal approval. What happened? What's happening? Are they still using humans? Are they still using animals? If so, do we freeze the fund? We need to assess all of that. So we have to implement a process where we are continuously monitoring the status of the approvals, and that we, if needed, impact access to the funds. We try to not go there. It is nice because within our McGill compliance offices, they do link, as Claude mentioned, they link their approvals into InfoRed. So anybody can go InfoRed and see there's an approval folder, and in that approval folder you can see if there's animals, humans, biohazard requests and requirements, and we enter start date, end date, and as Claude and Linda mentioned as well, it's 1 year approval. Every year it's got to be reapproved. Every year that date changes. If that date that is an InfoRed doesn't get changed, it is going to be picked up as a lapsed protocol. The issue that comes up at our end is that the affiliated REBs do not use InfoRed, do not link. Therefore, we are very much dependent on the PI or his research team sending us their updated IRB approvals or REB approvals, because their offices do not communicate with OSR. So we don't know that those protocols have been renewed. So in our system, they are going to come up as lapsed. So in the end, they're often false positives in that they really haven't lapsed, but our database hasn't been updated. So that is where we often are going to have issues. So we really need more help in getting the annual REB approvals to us. The animal is different because they do use one system only, and it is linked to InfoRed. The REB approvals are a little bit more difficult to manage because of the affiliated hospitals. So I would, again, if possible, message take home is talk to the labs,
talk to the people in the labs who manages the protocols on behalf of the PIs, the study coordinators, have them put it in their calendar that their REB approval will come up for renewal in 2-3 months, and have them put a note to say, hey, remember to tell OSR that this has been updated. It will help us tremendously to avoid these lapsed approvals. And the other take-home message is we do release of funds. Claude also went through that process, where, again, we're trying to not impede access to funds to PIs. We understand that animals, humans, may happen 2 years after, may happen 6 months, but they still need to hire the study coordinator to actually write the protocol, to actually develop the consent form, to actually develop the survey, whatever they're doing. We understand that. So the tri-agency does allow us to put in a release of funds process. We have a form for that. We do give it out to the PIs. If they say, I don't need approval right now, that's fine, but we will have them sign a form as to why they need approval, and that they understand that if they incur any animal or human subject expenses in the absence of necessary approvals, they are in potential breach of misconduct. It is their responsibility as a principal investigator to ensure that they are conducting research that has been ethically approved. There's no way that OSR can police that. Our role is to guide them the best we can into the right offices and say, you really need to talk to them, provide them with a release of funds, but after that, we just don't have the ability to police if they're yes or no, they're doing human subjects or animal without the necessary approvals. That does become a potential misconduct issue, and that we just don't have.
Bottom line, it is their responsibility, right?
It is. The PI's responsibility to ensure that they need compliance. Correct. It is their responsibility to ensure that they conduct the research with the necessary approvals. Like I said, we help them. Both our three offices give them reminders and all that, but we just can't police it. We also do not have the ability when we provide release of funds. We do not have the ability, RFMS doesn't have the ability, to see if animal or human subject fees are being charged to that fund. So if there are expenses being charged to a grant that has no protocol, ethics protocol attached to it, again, that becomes a PI's responsibility to know which grants are tied to which protocol. We just don't have the systems, the manpower to track it ourselves. So if that grant is being charged animal or human subject fees that have no protocol attached to it, approved protocol, if picked up for audit, those expenses could potentially be deemed ineligible on that grant and would have to be moved off. So again, it is a very manual process because there's just no other way to do it.
I just wanted to add to that. So like for the animal costs, sometimes they'll have a funding source that either stops the fund, like there's no more funding left, or they don't get renewed or whatever, and then they just provide another fund number, like the NSERC Discovery Grant or what, to house those costs, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they actually included the NSERC Discovery Grant under the animal protocol. So that's important to ensure that when they're moving the fund number to be charged for the animal fees, that it actually is related to the protocol. It's not just two different things that are going on. It has to be one global process.
The titles often do not match, especially we see it more with research human ethics, where again they get a global approval, a protocol to do, I'm going to be doing, whatever genetic work or whatever they do, but then they get grants, and when they submit their grants, they of course give it a different title, because one protocol, as we discussed initially, can cover multiple grants. So the titles don't always match. So again, if the PI gives us an IRB approval or an animal protocol approval, with the titles don't match, we have to rely on the investor saying, this protocol covers the work that's being conducted under this grant. The titles oftentimes basically aren't the same. So we have to trust that the PI, again, is telling us that this grant and this protocol jive, and they cover the work that needs to be done. For when to start the process, you've seen some timelines. The other take-home message is tell the investigators that as soon as they get their scores, if they deem they have a fundable score, a pretty good fundable score, they can start the process at that time. They shouldn't wait to actually get the funding in the door, because that's going to where it's going to stop access to funds. So if at all possible, if there is a fundable score, as Linda and Claude mentioned, they will consider putting through the protocol. If they don't get a fundable score or they don't get a score at all and it's just all of a sudden the notice of award appears, then we'll deal with it at that time. But if they get their score 2-3 months prior and they know that there's a, you know, their score is just, there's no way they're not going to get funded, then they can start their protocol process at that time and avoid a lot of delays. I don't know if Linda or Claude have anything else to say to that effect. No?
I just wanted, Catherine had a question. Did we answer that, or do you want some more information on the question that we held to the end? But basically, I just wanted to make clear that OSR, at the pre-award, like the grants officer, as well as awards administrators, awards officers, we are relying on the PI. Like when a grants officer reviews an application and they see that it's not noted, you know, that it's noted that the research doesn't involve human subjects and they're reading it may, they will recommend that they talk to the ethics office, but that doesn't necessarily happen every time. They don't necessarily have the expertise to be able to assess in each case how this person is, what method that person is using. So it's always important to make sure that, to make it clear that OSR, we do our best to advise and
point them in the right direction, but OSR is not the police on that. It's ultimately the researcher's responsibility to ensure that all activities conducted under the grant follow proper procedures. Even when it comes to applications submitted to agencies, if it's indicated that yes or no, it involves human subjects, doesn't involve human subjects, and the committee thinks it does, they don't necessarily take action on that either. They may put a note in the committee comments to say it seems like this may need ethics, but there's no check at that end either. So it really does, a lot of that responsibility falls on the PI and the research team. So,
okay, but so then in my position, it wouldn't be out of place for me, when I find out about the results for some competition, to remind professors, you know, you can start the ethics.
Yes, absolutely. Okay. Yes, yes. Absolutely.
I just wanted to make sure they weren't getting reminders from other directions that I wasn't seeing.
They will, but it's not a bad idea to give them more than, you know, a lot of people are pretty slow on that, so having several reminders is never a bad thing.
And okay. OSR doesn't necessarily see the scores. The PIs are notified of the scores ahead of time, so we don't necessarily see the review comments and the scores because that's most of the time considered confidential information directly to the PIs. So if they share that with you and they say, hey, I got a really good score, I'm super confident I'm going to get this, then say, hey, I see that you have humans or animals, start.
That only really applies to biomedical because NSHRC and NSERC were notified after the fact. Like the grants have technically already started and we're notified after that.
Exactly.
So,
so yes. Okay. So anytime you can help the PI move them in the right direction, it's a good idea. Okay. Another question?
We have a case where the PI was testing on animals but abroad, outside Canada. And we received the invoice, but only for the testing, no animals, boat or something. How that would be addressed?
Close your ears. I'm not answering.
No.
I mean, because we had to pay the invoice, right?
Yeah. I appreciate your question because I had a similar discussion with Claude this week, actually, where an investigator has a grant and indicated that animal would be needed only in the third year, but that they would be using an external company who that company would be doing the animal work and they would be the one obtaining the ethical approval and therefore didn't believe that they would need the approval here at McGill because it wouldn't be conducted here at McGill. So I contacted Claude, and I will let Claude explain what the answer was.
Well, as we mentioned before, the PI holds that grant, that CIHR or whatever agency / industrial grant. So the PI has to submit through the home institution.
So they still, there is animal research being conducted at another site, whether it be international, whether it be via CRO company that does these standardized animal testing, because the grant is awarded at McGill, the PI has responsibility to ensure that McGill oversight is obtained by the compliance office.
and that they would need to ask the company or the other institution to provide their animal protocol, their animal approval, and run it through the animal compliance here for oversight review. That is my understanding.
And basically, as I said earlier, there's only one protocol that is typically required. When there's work in both places, the two committees have to talk and decide which form will be used, either the collaborating or the local institution. But CCAC requires that one form be used, but that both committees are okay with it.
Yes, I understand that. But me as a finance, which is my extent, my responsibility there? Should I ask the PI, do you have a protocol on that? Did you go to the animal office?
Yeah. What as a finance I have to again, do? A good question is that you don't, I think you don't have a choice but to pay the invoice because they did the work and it is what it is. But I would very much caution you that you need to inform the PI to say, given that you have this invoice from this third party who did the work, have you contacted, do you have a McGill animal approval for this?
She would say yes.
Well, and if they say yes, you know what? Put that in writing. Send them an email to say, I've submitted this invoice on your behalf to be paid. As per our discussion, you indicated that you had received a McGill animal review for the work that was conducted off-site. There's not much more you can do. Again, as we've said it before, the ethical conduct of research is really a PI responsibility, and that becomes an issue of misconduct if they're conducting research. The issue is that they don't necessarily know. They think that because it's being conducted off-site, they don't need to get McGill oversight approval, but they do.
I have a quick comment.
So a lot of it is guiding them.
About that is that no matter what happens, if you're working within McGill and you have a doubt, it's good to inform the PI, and you're not the police, and I understand that, but to communicate that to the animal compliance office, and we'll do the research, you know, just a quick email just to let us know, oh, you know, I found something, I don't know if it's right or not. You know, it's good to lay it on the PI, but I don't completely trust them, so, and we have the departments, right? So we're there to check this out, so use us.
Yeah, we can be copied on correspondence, for instance, and that way we have a heads up and we can assist the PI that way.
Because and again, you can look in the InfoEd record. So if you're going to send the invoice through from a third party like that, you can go in InfoEd, and again, InfoEd is going to identify there's a folder in InfoEd called Approvals. And that folder is specifically to capture compliance approvals. So if you go in InfoEd, put in the fund number, that grant will pop up, go into the approval screen, and if there's no lab animal approval, right then and there you know there's an issue. And that's where you can tell the PI, I looked at InfoEd, this record doesn't have an animal approval, I don't think we can charge this expense to this grant, please contact the animal compliance office. But that's why InfoEd is there. That's why it's a tool for us to use to ensure that we're all working together. And oftentimes it's not that the PIs are wanting or they're it's just that they don't know.
Yeah. And we have another case, and it's one of our PIs to rent a snake to do a study to overcome fears.
No, sorry, it wasn't a study. It's like a therapy session. It wasn't research, and it wasn't research on the animal. It's basically like someone was scared of snakes, so they rented a snake to put in a room with this person to help this person get over their fears. And they kind of did it, and then we just got the invoice for it, and we were like, oh, I don't know if she can do this. But because it had already been done, it went through that time, but they have told us that in the future they could possibly do this again with other animal, like whatever animal that person fears.
You guys can jump in, but I don't think that that's in the context of a therapeutic.
Therapeutic, yeah.
So
doesn't matter. It's research. It involves a McGill person. They automatically need an animal use protocol.
It's not research. So if I go see a psychologist, a psychiatrist, because I have a massive fear of elevators, and they bring me to an elevator, that's not research.
No, so, but I'm not sure that I've heard of this.
We've actually been involved and asked for advice because during exam period, they now have pet therapy in the libraries.
This is not under our mandate. So this one sounds a little bit in a gray zone, and we can definitely get specifics and provide advice on that. Yeah. If there's a research, teaching, or testing aspect to it,
then yes,
there may be the need for ethics approval from us. If it's purely pet therapy type of intervention, it would potentially not be under our mandate, but better be safe than sorry is basically what it is. And in the other case where there's an invoice, I mentioned there are exceptions. One of the exceptions is, for instance, if a researcher uses tissue that was harvested from live animals under another protocol somewhere else, but they never have anything to do with the live animals, like the tissue wasn't harvested from animals that were raised for that purpose. It just happens that
they purchase
the tissue that was used for another research project. They may not need an animal protocol. So that's where it's important when there's a gray zone to refer them to us. We can provide advice once we get the specifics.
And we often do that as well in OSR, where if we're not clear and the PI is asking a lot of questions, we refer them back to the appropriate offices because we're definitely not the expert in compliance requirements.
Yeah.
Any other questions? I think this was a great session. I've definitely learned a lot, and I extend my thank you on behalf of the RAND committee to Linda and Claude. Thank you very much for attending. And if there's any additional questions after, well, you have their contact information. Thank you again.